A certain red planet and how it made a household name out of a kid from Wisconsin named Orson Welles. That's our focus of this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David McKenzie.
Thank you.
Shorty Rogers and His Giants, with a 1954 recording titled Martians Go Home. That was certainly the sentiment felt by quite a few folks on the East Coast on the 30th of October, 1938, when a certain novella by a certain Mr. Wells was made into a compelling radio drama by another certain Mr. Wells. Of course, the novella was The War of the Worlds, an 1898 work by the great British fantasy writer H.G. Wells, and the beneficiary of the publicity, once he survived the initial furor, was the actor Orson Welles. The story of what went on that night to cause radio listeners to believe that an invasion of malicious extraterrestrials was destroying the New Jersey countryside on its way to New York City is told in full on several websites on the World Wide Web. Perhaps the most comprehensive site is found at www.war-of-the-worlds.co.uk. Once again, www.war-of-the-worlds.co.uk. One fascinating aspect of the phenomenon is that the Orson Welles broadcast, part of his Mercury Theater on the Air series on the CBS network at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday nights, was directly opposite the top-rated program in all of American radio that season, the Chase and Sanborn Hour on the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company. In 1966, a study by Professor Hadley Cantrill of Princeton University, coincidentally a real-life university that figured into the Wells broadcast's fictional narrative, found that about 20% of those listening that night, including almost all of those who had panicked, had tuned into the Chase and Sanborn program first and then tuned over to the Wells program after the first comedy sketch featuring ventriloquist Edgar Bergen and his character Charlie McCarthy had ended, roughly 15 minutes into the two programs. On this broadcast of Echoes of a Century, what we've done is to take both of these broadcasts, the Chase and Sanborn and Mercury Theater programs of October the 30th of 1938, and combine them into one item, starting with the first quarter hour of the Chase and Sanborn hour up to the general point where most listeners would have tuned over. And then we'll tune over to the Wells broadcast and remain there until the station break, by which time the widespread panic was well underway. This is an approximation of what would have been heard through those radio speakers on that historic night. Oh, and you will want to pay special attention to the actor playing the Secretary of the Interior on the Wells broadcast. That part was actually originally written for the actor, Kenny Delmar, to impersonate President Franklin Roosevelt. The CBS censors ruled that out before the program was produced, changing the character to the lesser-known cabinet member. But director Wells told Delmar, "Come on, Kenny, you know what I want there." Thus, every fourth word or so was delivered by Delmar in an FDR-like inflection, so that while the character was clearly identified as the Secretary of the Interior, the inference that it was supposed to be the president was understood by most listeners. Program producer John Houseman would say years later that that was the only bit of naughty business actually committed that night, the rest of the show being simply good radio drama.
Makers of Chase and Sanborn Coffee, the superb blend you know is fresh, present the Chase and Sanborn Hour, and your host, Don Amici.
This is Don Ameche, rounding up the Chase and Sanborn gang and greeting you for all of them. A hearty hello from Nelson Eddy, Dorothy L'Amour, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, Robert Arm Brewster, and Judy Canova with Annie and Zeke. We hope that you'll enjoy our show and that throughout the week you'll remain our friends as well as friends of Chase and Sanborn. With a...
Howdy, Mr. Ameche.
Oh, hello, Judy. Is there anything I can do for you?
Say, you know, Mr. Ameche, I've been looking at that little McCarthy fella for 4 weeks now, and I'll be dogged if I can figure him out.
Yeah, well, don't try it, Judy. We all have the same trouble.
It sure is mystifying how them words comes a-bouncing across his wooden tonsils, ain't it?
Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah, and you know I keep a-thinking of what folks down in Unadilla would do if they seed him.
Would they be amazed, Judy?
Amazed? Listen, Mr. Ameche, did you ever see a tree walking? Like as not, they hang a sap bucket on to it.
No, no, no. Hey, what's going on here?
Oh, well, Charlie, Judy only meant
that. Yeah, I heard what she said. I heard.
Oh, shucks, Charlie. I was only complimenting you. Hmm. Why, you ain't got nothing against me, have you?
No, but I can very easily develop something.
Listen here, now that's too bad, Charles M. You see, I was hoping that I and you could sort of kind of get together like, you know.
Uh-oh.
I sort of like you.
You do?
I sure do.
Bergen, get your gun.
Never mind, Charlie. I'm sure you'll feel better when you know that our guest tonight is one of our mutual friends, honoring us with a return visit, the lovely Madeline Carroll.
Oh, Madeline, da-da-da-dum, da-da.
Thanks, Charlie, but we'll let Nelson Eddy do the singing. And it's the rousing, rip-roaring Song of the Vagabonds from the Vagabond King.
Come on, you beggars of Paris town, you lazy rabble of low degree.
You rabble of low degree.
You spare King Louis to keep his crown and save our city from Burgundy.
Our city from Burgundy.
You and I are good for nothing but to die. We can die for liberty. Will you serve a stranger and bow down to Burgundy? Sons of shame and sorrow, will you cheer tomorrow for the crown of Burgundy? Onward, onward, swords against the foe. Forward, forward, the lily banners go. Sons of France around us, break the chain that bound us, and away with Burgundy.
Sons of toil and danger, will you serve a stranger and bow down to Burgundy? Sons of shame and sorrow, will you cheer tomorrow for the crown of Burgundy?
Rough and ready man of Canada, a big, brawny French-Canadian logger, the kind of a fellow who skips nimbly from log to log as they float downstream to the mill. Sure-footedly, he prevents the dreaded jams, and yet he always seems to find time to wave at the girls on the shore. Nelson Eddy sings the Canadian logging song.
Down the rivage we float, the logs they make the ground a boat. On the logs we leap and laugh as safe upon the logs as on the road. There's a rock, watch out, mon frere, you maybe get a big shipwreck there. The sun is shining on the shore, we see big salmon jump some more, some more. Down the rapids we hear them roar, now may flag it on the shore, hola. See the logs, they make
stampede like herd of cows and on to lead. With log and pole, we have to leap to coax them out from log jam deep. A log jam is so hard to coax as a crowd of tricky women folks. The river bends, we get a view of Petite de Ville, les filles. We wave and they smile, we know, all right. We see them again at the dance tonight, hola, hola. To those black eyes, we promise to be true. We dance the whole night through. On the rivage we float the log, she make the ground a boat. On the logs we leap and laugh, a safe upon the logs as on the raft. Hola, 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 hola.
A-haunting we will go, cha 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 cha. A-haunting we will go.
Hey, Charlie, the word is hunting.
Well, not on Halloween, it ain't.
Say, what are you going to do tomorrow night, Charlie?
Oh, I don't know. Duck for apples, I guess. What else can a fellow do on a measly 75 cents a week?
All right. Charlie, I wish you wouldn't take advantage of every opportunity to mention the allowance I give you.
Oh?
No.
Why?
It's embarrassing.
Yeah. I am ashamed of it too, Bergen. Yeah.
All you think of is money. Pleasure can be derived in many other ways.
Name four.
Well, say, Edgar, aren't you going to stage a Halloween party for Charlie tomorrow night?
I certainly am not, Don. Oh. I haven't forgotten Charlie's party last year when he ruined the furniture and the carpets.
Yeah, and broke windows, too.
Yes, yes.
Don't forget your broken windows.
Four broken windows.
Yeah, five.
Five?
Yeah. I broke one after you took inventory.
Oh.
What a party. Talk about laughs and the fun we had. Oh, gee. I remember it still.
I can assure you there will be no repetition of last year's riot.
No.
No. That experiment was much too expensive.
Oh, sure. No party this year?
No party.
Oh. Aren't you going to do anything for a little itsy-bitsy Charlie on this Halloween?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No. Oh, I may tell you a ghost story.
Yeah. A ghost story?
Yes.
Do you think you can afford it?
Oh, yes.
Say, Edgar, I like ghost stories. Do you know any good ones?
Well, I know one, Don.
Hey, you don't mind if I join you, do you, Edgar? I like to listen to ghost stories.
Well, not at all, Nelson.
Oh, Edgar, are you going to tell a ghost story?
Yes.
I love them. They frighten me to death.
You better sit close to me, Dottie. Hold my hand.
Well, this isn't really a ghost story.
No?
No. It's an actual experience.
Oh, sure. They all start out that way.
A friend of mine by the name of Joe Franklin purchased an 8-room house in Hoosick Falls, which is a small town in upper New York.
How far is that?
How far is what?
Hoosick Falls.
What about it?
How far is it?
Well, from where?
Oh. Thank you anyway. I still don't think it's the right answer.
Well, anyway, my friend, he bought this old house.
Say, how many rooms did you say it had, Edgar?
8 rooms.
How charming. 8 rooms? 2-story?
No, it's a ghost story.
As a matter of fact, Dorothy, it was a 2-story house. But the upstairs quarters were never used because there was a rumor that they were haunted.
They were what?
I say, they were inhabited by ghosts.
Well, didn't Joe Hoosick know that before he bought the place?
The name is Joe Franklin, and the house is in Hoosick Falls.
Oh, I see. Well, you want to watch that, Edgar?
So,
say, Ed, did Joe Falls know that Hoosick was haunted?
Yeah. Don, the name is Franklin, and the house is in Hoosick Falls. Yeah. It was an 8-story, 2-room house.
We got him, boys. We
an 8-story, 2-room house, huh?
What he means, it's an 8-house, 2-story room. No.
No.
Did anybody live in it?
Yeah, Hoosick lived downstairs. And he raised goats upstairs.
Now, wait a minute. Who lived in what?
Mr. Poughkeepsie. Lived in Schenectady. I don't know. What is this?
Well, I don't think you people want to hear this story at all. Of course, if you don't, we'll just say so that...
Now, Bergen, don't be sensitive now.
Lady, at least give me the curse.
Of course we want to hear the story, don't we, Don?
Why, sure we do. Have you heard it before, Charlie?
Yeah, I hear it every Halloween. He does it. He brings it out, yeah.
Is it a good story?
It's awful. But let's egg him on.
Yeah. Oh, come on, Edgar. Tell us the rest of the story. What was your friend's name?
Oh, well, let's forget his name, and let's forget he's my friend.
Oh, forgetting friends, huh? What's the matter? Did he write for money?
No. He did not write for money. Do you understand? No, he didn't.
Oh. Is him sore, Bergen?
No.
Oh, come on, Edgar. We'll behave. Tell us.
Very well. I shall make a final attempt, but I insist on absolute silence.
Yes, you got to have it quiet now. It's going to have it quiet.
And stop whispering, please.
Yes. Excuse me. Is it all right if I breathe a little?
Oh, yeah. Now, this is a true story.
Uh-huh.
But if at any time you question the veracity of my statements, stop me.
We sure will.
This incident took place about 8 years ago, at which time I was considered quite a handsome young man.
Stop! All right. You can't sell us on that.
All right. Charlie, if you'll only keep quiet, you'll find that this story is very, very gripping.
Griping is the word.
All right.
Now, you keep quiet, Charlie. We want to hear this story.
Thank you, Don.
Okay, Edgar.
Who are you? All right. Two-faced and
all right. Yeah. Now, where was I?
You're right here.
Yes, I am. Picture, if you can, an old house with the foundation settling, sagging roof, peeling wallpaper. Can you picture it?
Picture it? We live in it.
In this house, there had formerly lived an old miser. Of course, you know what a miser is.
Oh, sure. A miser is a man who thinks 75 cents a...
No.
No, you don't.
That burns him up.
Now, this miser had lived and died in one of the upstairs bedrooms, and it was believed that his ghost haunted it.
The plot thickens.
And do you know, Charlie, I was the first person brave enough to spend a night in that bedroom.
Sure.
Nothing happened until midnight.
Nothing ever does.
And then, out of the still of the night, I heard the old grandfather's clock in the hall strike the witching hour.
Bong! Cuckoo! Cuckoo!
Don, will you please stop?
Yeah, when you hear the next cuckoo, it'll be exactly Bergen.
Yeah. All right, enough of that.
Yeah. Fellas, will you stop interrupting? Gee, you're being very rude.
Oh, now, keep quiet,
and very
Charlie.
Unfunny. And the least you can do...
All right. Will you stop, too, Charlie?
Oh, me?
Yes.
How is...
You're the worst one of all.
Is that so?
Yes. Gee. Shortly after midnight, I heard a peculiar noise, as if someone were tapping on the walls.
Oh,
all right.
I thought I saw something.
No. Tapping on the walls.
Yes.
And I heard footsteps on the ceiling. I couldn't figure out what it was.
Maybe you had a snootful.
No.
I was only trying to help.
Well, please don't.
All right.
No. Then suddenly, the steps got closer and closer. And then, without warning, a horrible figure pounced upon me. Something tugged at my memory. Where had I seen that ghostly face before?
In a mirror?
No. That settles it.
That settles what?
I'm not going to finish this story.
Well, why not?
Well, I'm not going to make a fool of myself.
Oh, I don't know.
Yes, you're right. I have made a fool of myself.
Well, it certainly took you long enough to get wise.
A few years ago, a song about a couple of people who were very, very tired swept the country. Remember, Let's Put Out the Lights and Go to Sleep?
Hey, keep those men back! Keep those idiots back!
Well, Ladies. He's off! The cop's loose!
Look out there! Stand back!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Someone crawling
someone
out
or
something I can see turning out of that black hole, two luminous disks. The eyes, it might be a face, might be almost... Good heavens, something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me. Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body. Now it's large. It's large as a bear. It glistens like wet leather, but that face... Ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful. The eyes are black and they gleam like a serpent. The mouth is that kind of V-shaped with saliva dripping from its rimless lips. It seems to quiver and pulsate. And the monster or whatever it is can hardly move. It seems weighed down by possibly gravity or something. The thing's rising up now and the crowd falls back. It seems plenty. The most extraordinary experience, ladies and gentlemen. I can't find words. Well, I'll pull this microphone with me as I talk. I have to stop the description until I can take a new position. Hold on, will you, please? I'll be right back in a minute.
We are bringing you an eyewitness account of what's happening on the Wilmoth Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Now return you to Carl Phillips at Grover's Mill.
Ladies and gentlemen, is my aunt? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain's conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute. Something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. And make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Ah! Oh, the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission. However, we will return to that point at the earliest opportunity. In the meantime, we have a late bulletin from San Diego, California. Professor Indelkoffer, speaking at a dinner of the California Astronomical Society, expressed the opinion that the explosions on Mars are undoubtedly nothing more than severe volcanic disturbances on the surface of the planet. We continue now with our piano interlude.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've just been handed a message that came in from Grover's Mill by telephone. Just one moment, please. At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead in a field east of the village of Grover's Mill. Their bodies burned and distorted beyond all possible recognition. The next voice you hear will be that of Brigadier General Montgomery Smith, commander of the state militia at Trenton, New Jersey.
I have been requested by the governor of New Jersey to place the counties of Mercer and Middlesex as far west as Princeton and east to Jamesburg under martial law. No one will be permitted to enter this area except by special pass issued by state or military authorities. 4 companies of state militia are proceeding from Trenton to Grover's Mill and will aid in the evacuation of homes within the range of military operations. Thank you.
You have just been listening to General Montgomery Smith, commanding the state militia at Trenton. In the meantime, further details of the catastrophe at Grover's Mill are coming in. The strange creatures, after unleashing their deadly assault, crawled back in their pit and made no attempt to prevent the efforts of the firemen to recover the bodies and extinguish the fire. The combined fire departments of Mercer County are fighting the flames which menace the entire countryside. We have been unable to establish any contact with our mobile unit at Grover's Mill, but we hope to be able to return you there at the earliest possible moment. In the meantime, we take you to... Just one moment, please. Ladies and gentlemen, I have just been informed that we have finally established communication with an eyewitness of the tragedy. Professor Pearson has been located at a farmhouse near Grover's Mill, where he has established an emergency observation post. As a scientist, he will give you his explanation of the calamity. The next voice you hear will be that of Professor Pearson, brought to you by direct wire. Professor Pearson.
Of the creatures in the rocket cylinder at Grover's Mill, I can give you no authoritative information, either as to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth. Of their destructive instrument, I might venture some conjectural explanation. For want of a better term, I shall refer to the mysterious weapon as a heat ray. It's all too evident that these creatures have scientific knowledge far in advance of our own. It's my guess that in some way they are able to generate an intense heat in a chamber of practically absolute non-conductivity. This intense heat they project in a parallel beam against any object they choose by means of a polished parabolic mirror of unknown composition, much as the mirror of a lighthouse projects a beam of light. That is my conjecture of the origin of the heat ray.
Thank you, Professor Pearson. Ladies and gentlemen, here is a bulletin from Trenton. It is a brief statement informing us that the charred body of Carl Phillips has been identified in a Trenton hospital. Now, here's another bulletin from Washington, D.C., the office of the director of the National Red Cross reports 10 units of Red Cross emergency workers have been assigned to the headquarters of the state militia, stationed outside of Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Here's a bulletin from State Police, Princeton Junction. The fires at Grover's Mill and vicinity are now under control. Scouts report all quiet in the pit, and there is no sign of life appearing from the mouth of the cylinder. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a special statement from Mr. Harry McDonald, vice president in charge of operations.
We have received a request from the state militia of Trenton to place at their disposal our entire broadcasting facilities. In view of the gravity of the situation, and believing that radio has a responsibility to serve in the public interest at all times, we are turning over our facilities to the state militia at Trenton.
We take you now to the field headquarters of the state militia near Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
This is Captain Lansing of the Signal Corps, attached to the state militia, now engaged in military operations in the vicinity of Grover's Mill. Situation arising from the reported presence of certain individuals of unidentified nature is now under complete control. The cylindrical object, which lies in a pit directly below our position, surrounded on all sides by 8 battalions of infantry, without heavy field pieces, but adequately armed with rifles and machine guns. All cause for alarm, if such cause ever existed, is now entirely unjustified. Things, whatever they are, do not even venture to poke their heads above the pit. I can see their hiding place plainly in the glare of the searchlights here. With all their reported resources, these creatures can scarcely stand up against heavy machine gun fire. Anyway, it's an interesting outing for the troops. I can make out their khaki uniforms crossing back and forth in front of the lights. Looks almost like a real war. There appears to be some slight smoke in the woods bordering the Millstone River. Probably fire started by campers. Well, we ought to see some action soon. One of the companies is deploying on the left flank. A quick thrust and it'll all be over. Now, wait a minute. I see something on top of the cylinder. No, it's nothing but a shadow. Now the troops are on the edge of the Wilmot Farm. 7,000 armed men closing in on an old metal tube. A tub, rather. Well, wait, that wasn't a shadow. It's something moving. Solid metal, kind of a shield-like affair rising up out of the cylinder. It's going higher and higher. What? It's standing on legs, actually rearing up on a sort of metal framework. Now it's reaching above the trees and the searchlights are on it. Hold on.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars. The battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times. 7,000 men armed with rifles and machine guns pitted against a single fighting machine of the invaders from Mars. 120 known survivors. The rest strewn over the battle area from Grover's Mill to Plainsboro, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray. The monster is now in control of the middle section of New Jersey and has effectively cut the state through its center. Communication lines are down from Pennsylvania to the Atlantic Ocean. Railroad tracks are torn and service from New York to Philadelphia discontinued, except routing some of the trains through Allerton and Phoenixville. Highways to the north, south, and west are clogged with frantic human traffic. Police and army reserves are unable to control the mad flight. By morning, the fugitives will have swelled Philadelphia, Camden, and Trenton, it is estimated, to twice their normal population. Martial law prevails throughout New Jersey and eastern Pennsylvania. At this time, we take you to Washington for a special broadcast on the national emergency. The Secretary of the Interior.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people. However, I wish to impress upon you, private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action. Fortunately, this formidable enemy is still confined to a comparatively small area, and we may place our faith in the military forces to keep them there. In the meantime, placing our faith in God, we must continue the performance of our duties, each and every one of us, so that we may confront this destructive adversary with a nation united, courageous, and consecrated to the preservation of human supremacy on this earth. I thank you.
You have just heard the Secretary of the Interior speaking from Washington. Bulletins too numerous to read are piling up in the studio here. We're informed that the central portion of New Jersey is blacked out from radio communication due to the effect of the heat ray upon power lines and electrical equipment. Here is a special bulletin in New York. Cables have been received from English, French, and German scientific bodies offering assistance. Astronomers report continued gas outbursts at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The majority voiced the opinion that the enemy will be reinforced by additional rocket machines. There have been several attempts made to locate Professor Pearson of Princeton, who has observed Martians at close range. It is feared he was lost in the recent battle. Langham Field, Virginia. Scouting planes report three Martian machines visible above treetops, moving north toward Somerville with population fleeing ahead of them. The heat ray is not in use, although advancing at express train speed, invaders pick their way carefully. They seem to be making a conscious effort to avoid destruction of cities and countryside. However, they stop to uproot power lines, bridges, and railroad tracks. Their apparent objective is to crush resistance, paralyze communication, and disorganize human society. Here is a bulletin from Basking Ridge, New Jersey. Coon hunters have stumbled on a second cylinder similar to the first, embedded in the great swamp 20 miles south of Morristown. Army field pieces are proceeding from Newark to blow up the second invading unit before the cylinder can be opened and the fighting machine rigged. They are taking up a position in the foothills of Watchung Mountains. Another bulletin from Langham Field, Virginia. Scouting planes report enemy machines, now three in number, increasing speed northward, kicking over houses and trees in their evident haste to form a conjunction with their allies south of Morristown. Machines also sighted by telephone operator east of Middlesex, within 10 miles of Plainfield. Here's a bulletin from Winston Field, Long Island. A fleet of army bombers carrying heavy explosive flying north in pursuit of enemy. Scouting planes act as guides. They keep the speeding enemy in sight. Just a moment, please, ladies and gentlemen. We've run special wires to the artillery line and adjacent villages to give you direct reports in the zone of the advancing enemy. First, we take you to the battery of the 22nd Field Artillery, located in the Watchung Mountains.
Range 32 meters.
32 meters.
Direction 39 degrees.
39 degrees.
Fire.
Yards to the right, sir.
Ship range, 31 meters.
31 meters.
Projection, 37 degrees.
37 degrees.
Fire.
Hit, sir. Got the tripod of one of them. They're stopped. The others are trying to repair it.
Quick, get the range. Ship 50, 30 meters.
30 meters.
Projection, 27 degrees.
27 degrees.
Fire.
Can't see the shell land, sir. Letting off a smoke.
What is it?
Black smoke, sir. Moving this way. Lying close to the ground. Moving fast.
Put on gas masks. Get ready to fire. Shift to 24 meters.
24 meters.
Projection 24 degrees.
24 degrees.
Fire.
Still can't see, sir. Smoke's coming nearer.
Get the range.
23 meters.
23 meters. 23 meters.
Projection 22.
22.
Army bombing plane B-843 off Bayonne, New Jersey. Lieutenant Bolt commanding 8 bombers, reporting to Commander Fairfax Langham Field. This is Bolt reporting to Commander Fairfax, Langham Field. Enemy tripod machines now in sight. Reinforced by 3 machines from the Morristown cylinder. 6 altogether. 1 machine partially crippled. Believed hit by shell from Army gun in Wachung Mountains. Guns now appear silent. A heavy black fog hanging close to the earth of extreme density, nature unknown. No sign of heat ray. Enemy now turns east, crossing Passaic River into the Jersey Marshes. Another straddles the Pulaski Skyway. Evident objective is New York City. They're pushing down a high-tension power station. The machines are close together now, and we're ready to attack. Planes circling, ready to strike. A 1,000 yards, and we'll be over the first. Yards. 600. 400. 200. There they go. The giant arm raised. Green flash. They're spraying us with flame. 2,000 feet. Engines are giving out. No chance to release bombs. Only one thing left. Drop on them, plane and all. We're diving on the first one. Now the engine's gone. 8.
This is Bayonne, New Jersey, calling Langham Field. Bayonne, New Jersey, calling Langham Field. Come in, please.
This is Langham Field. Go ahead.
8 Army bombers in engagement with enemy tripod machines over Jersey Flats. Engines incapacitated by heat ray. All crashed. 1 enemy machine destroyed. Enemy now discharging heavy black smoke in direction of...
This is Newark, New Jersey. This is Newark, New Jersey. Warning. Poisonous black smoke pouring in from Jersey marshes. Reach at South Street. Gas masks useless. Urge population to move into open spaces. Automobiles use routes 7, 23, 24. Avoid congested areas. Smoke now spreading over Raymond Boulevard.
Two X to L calling 8X3R. Come in, please.
This is 8X3R coming back at 2X2L.
How's reception? How's reception? K, please. Where are you, 8X3R? What's the matter? Where are you?
I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building. I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building, New York City. The bells you hear are ringing to warn the people to evacuate the city as Martians approach. Estimated in the last 2 hours, 3 million people have moved out along the roads to the north. Hutchinson River Parkway still kept open for motor traffic. Avoid bridges to Long Island, hopelessly jammed. All communication with Jersey Shore closed 10 minutes ago. No more defenses. Our army is wiped out. Artillery, Air Force, everything wiped out. This may be the last broadcast. We'll stay here to the end. People are holding service here below us in the cathedral. Now I look down the harbor, all manner of boats, overloaded with fleeing population, pulling out from docks. Streets are all jammed. Noise and crowds like New Year's Eve in city. Wait a minute. The enemy is now in sight above the Palisades. Five great machines. First one is crossing the river. I can see it from here, wading the Hudson like a man wading through a brook. A bulletin is handed me. Martian cylinders are falling all over the country. One outside of Buffalo, one in Chicago, St. Louis. Seem to be timed and spaced. Now the first machine reaches the shore. He stands watching, looking over the city. Steel cowlish head is even with the skyscrapers. He waits for the others. Rise like a line of new towers on the city's west side. Now they're lifting their metal hands. This is the end now. Smoke comes out, black smoke drifting over the city. People in the streets see it now. They're running toward the East River, thousands of them, dropping in like rats. Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke's crossing 6th Avenue. 5th Avenue. 100 yards away. It's 50 feet.
You
You are listening to a CBS presentation of Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the Air in an original dramatization of The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. The performance will continue after a brief intermission. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The sounds of the radio on the night of October the 30th, 1938. Radio was never quite the same after that. That concludes this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. This program was an independent production by Doll Shoe Radio Creations, copyright 2005, produced in the studios of WLSU La Crosse, an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio on the La Crosse campus of the University of Wisconsin. I'm King David McKenzie. Thanks for listening. I hope that you'll join us again at this same time next week. Until then, remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space.